Yes, indeed. Today is my birthday, but it's quite a significant birthday because I am 80 years old. And I just can't believe it. You know that I've lived 7 decades and now entering a new one. And in January, when the year was turning over to 2024, I was beginning to dread that I would turn 80 this year. But this summer, I participated in the women's book study. We read Choosing Gratitude by Nancy DeMoss Wolgamuth. And it really changed my perspective. It's called Choosing Gratitude. It's a very good book. And so I am grateful for the years that God has given me, and I want to continue to serve him, and he has blessed me immensely. In Psalm 90, here's a prayer of Moses, and verse 12 says, "So teach me to number our days, that we may get a heart of wisdom." So we all need more wisdom as we carry on. And as Betty King frequently said, "I want to finish strong. I don't know how much time the Lord has left for me, whether it's 3 years or 15 years, if he tarries, but I want to be found faithful in serving him because he's been faithful to me." And thank you so much for your cards and greetings. I really appreciate it. Well, and speaking of being faithful, God was certainly faithful to the Israelites, as we learn as we begin this study. I picked up a cold somewhere, so pardon my voice. I sound like I'm down in the basement. So I might be sipping quite a bit. So we're going to begin the study of the book of Exodus. Over 400 years, 430. If you have your handouts, you can just follow along and fill in as you want to. So over 430 years have elapsed since Joseph lived in Egypt and brought his family of 70 souls to be with him there. It appears on the surface that God has been silent at this time, but he was not silent. He was working behind the scenes, arranging all of the circumstances that would lead to the Exodus. You may have had periods in your own life where you thought God is silent. Maybe you're in one of them right now, that it appears he's not there. Is he hearing your prayers? You call on him, but your prayer might even seem empty. Is it getting up there? Is it going beyond the ceiling? And you're wondering if he hears. Well, we're reminded of the story of Lazarus. His sister sent word to Jesus to come because Lazarus was dying, but he didn't come. He appears silent, but he told his disciples in this delay, "It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it." And then, of course, he raises Lazarus from the dead. And that was a very short time. But he was silent. He didn't come when they wanted him to. So in our story today, God appears to have been silent. But he's working, and he is working in your life. So as we read the first chapter, we see it begins with the names of the sons of Israel. The book of Exodus actually begins with the word "and" in Hebrew. It doesn't begin with "and the sons of Israel were." And I've given you this handout that shows the names, but as I was just coming up here, I noticed that the bottom three are cut off, so I'll give you a new sheet next week. But I believe the one with the wheat branches is Joseph, and the one on the far right is Benjamin. And does anybody know who would be the boat? So whoever's missing, whoever is not listed there. But it has their name, the meaning of their name, and their symbol, like Judah, the Lion of Judah. And of course, Jesus came from that line. Okay, so the book begins with the word and it's a continuation of the Genesis story. So let's look and see what we have in store. In this book, we do definitely have a need for God's deliverance, and we see the faithfulness of God, even in this short chapter. Your book gives you a map, but I put one up here on the screen too. Joseph settled his family in the area of Goshen, and this was prime, fertile, green, lush real estate. It is north of Cairo. So you see the pyramids there, and you see that red circle. We don't exactly know where Goshen was, so I just kind of plopped it in there. But it's in that general area because it's right by the Nile, and it was very green and lush, and it was very helpful to the Israelites to thrive in agriculture. Well, now, 430 years later, a new king, a pharaoh, comes to power who did not know Joseph. At this time, a nation state was ruling Egypt called the Hyksos, H-Y-K-S-O-S, the Hyksos. And they were a tribe or nation state from the Middle Asia, but they had come over and conquered Egypt at this time and had ruled for several centuries. But for clarity, I'm still going to refer to them as Egyptians and the pharaoh as Egyptian, but he was actually Hyksos. All right? So this new pharaoh was not pleased that there were so many Israelites who had grown in number to 600,000 men, plus all the women and children. 600,000 men, 20 years or older. He considered them a threat to his power. And because it was the enemy, because if an enemy came he to make war against Egypt, he felt that the Jews would side with the invaders and that he'd be overrun. Please do take a look at question one in your books today, because that shows you how fruitful the Israelites were being. And it should be compared with Genesis, where God tells them to be fruitful and multiply, and it's being fulfilled in Exodus. And notice the similarity of verbs that you're going to see there. Well, for this new pharaoh, there were too many Jews. He began to oppress them. Anti-Semitism is not new. What kind of conditions were the Israelites living under in Egypt in 1400 BC? How did these conditions show the need for redemption? The main theme of the book. One of the resources I'm using shows four reasons Israel needed redemption, and I'd like to share them with you. So the first one is they were in political slavery. They were in bondage. And that's shown in verses 8 to 10. The Pharaoh says in verse 8, "Let us deal shrewdly with them." What does shrewd actually mean? It means having or showing astute or sharp judgment in practical matters, sometimes at the cost of moral compromise. So he compromised morals in trying to get rid of the Jews. It also means cunning or tricky, keen, piercing, and an obsolete meaning, but perhaps one that fits the Pharaoh, is malicious or evil, even bad. So these people had no political freedom, no rights, no benefits, no say. To the Pharaoh, they were just pawns on the chessboard to be moved around at will and for his pleasure, for his kingdom. They were a threat, and he proceeded to act with evil intent towards them. We are not politically slaves in bondage in our country, and I so certainly hope you're registered to vote. There are many Christians across the country that feel strongly about political issues in our country, but they don't register to vote. And so I hope that you are registered, and I hope that you will vote biblically, as close as we can get with the people who are running. All right, the next reason for their need for redemption is because they were in economic slavery. This is shown in verses 11 to 14. The Pharaoh used them for slave labor. Notice the heavy negative language in these verses. Words like heavy burden, oppressed, worked the Israelites ruthlessly, bitter with difficult labor. These words describe enslavement. The Jews were working on two building projects for the king, building two supply cities, Pithom and Ramses. They were not working on the pyramids, which had been built centuries before. He makes crushing demands on them and treats them mercilessly. The Pharaoh doesn't go as far as Hitler in exterminating all the Jews because he needs their slave labor. He needs them, but not all of them. And most unfortunately, we still have slavery in our country today. It's estimated that there are over 45 million people in modern-day slavery, and 1/4 of these are children. That's about 12 million children. And many of these are girls caught in forced marriages at ages as young as 5. Here in our own country, it's estimated that 300,000 children crossing the southern border have disappeared and are thought to be in sex trafficking or child labor. Last year, you might have seen the movie Sound of Freedom. Anybody see that? It's really a good movie. But that showed how young children get entrapped by exploitation and then sold into slavery. Human trafficking is the second largest organized crime in the world. Human trafficking. And the root causes of this are evil because it's for financial greed. They're just selfish. I hate to even tell you this, but it was pointed out in that movie that, like with a drug, you just sell it once. But with a young girl, she can be sold 5 and 6 times a day. And so it's just their greed. They're getting money from these poor kids because of these kids. And then sexual perversion, of course, that somebody would be so perverse to use a small child. We as Christians can become involved by praying that this curse will be lifted, but we can also get involved, whether financially or actively, in organizations working to free these people. Just a couple of examples are the Tim Tebow organization, International Justice Mission, which is a Christian organization, and the anti-slavery organization. If you Google online Christian anti-slavery organizations, you'll get quite a list. And we need to remember that God is a God of justice. He doesn't like slavery. He wants people to be free. Psalm 106, 6 and 7 state, "The Lord works righteousness and justice for all who are oppressed. He made known his ways to Moses, his acts to the children of Israel." So he did not like the oppression that they were facing, and he freed them. And I've given you some other references there on your handout that you might like to look up if you have time. So the children of Israel needed redemption as well as people in bondage in our contemporary world. So the third example of slavery was social slavery. And this is the oppression of the people. It just continues as the Egyptians act more and more brutally toward them. Then the Pharaoh initiates what could be called state-sponsored genocide. He wants to kill all the male Hebrew babies. But instead of doing it himself or through his fellow Egyptians, he passes the buck to the birthing nurses, the Israelite midwives, represented by Shifra and Pua. There were many other midwives, but these women are maybe the head of the Israeli Midwife Association or something. And he calls them in, and he tells them to kill the babies as soon as they're born on the birthing stool. The women of that time sat on a stool in the final stages of labor and then either laid on the floor or squatted to have their babies. However, as you well know, Shifra and Pua did not heed the king's directive. They may have feared the king, but they feared God more. The protection of human life was more important than obeying the king. The king confronts them about the continued births, but Shiphrah and Puah tell him that the Hebrew women are vigorous and the babies are born before they can get there. That was probably true, but maybe not all of them, but but that's what he tells them, or they tell him. So we do not have the entire conversation between the Pharaoh and the midwives, but we have this, but they determined that we must obey God rather than men. That verse comes from Acts when Peter says that after being told by the Sanhedrin to stop teaching and preaching in Jesus' name, we must obey God rather than men. God's standard of the sanctity of life was more important than man's flawed legal demands. Similar examples of standing against the government in saving people can be found throughout history, but we remember those who saved the Jews in World War II, people like Corrie Ten Boom and many thousands of others who illegally harbored the Jews, or in our own country, people being part of the Underground Railroad and illegally transporting slaves to freedom. Saving people is much more important than an immoral law. Also remember, Shiphrah and Puah acted before they had the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are revealed in this book of Exodus. So thou shalt not kill. That doesn't come till many chapters later. God's moral law was written in their hearts, and they acted on it. So God was moving, excuse me, although to many, he probably appeared silent. His plans and purposes were not being thwarted. These women who obeyed God rather than men did something for us. Because they rescued the babies, we will be raised from the dead. What you say, what? But if we do not have these women who rescued, we do not have Moses, the Exodus, David, Mary, or Jesus, who are all descendants of these Jews. It's very interesting to note that we have recorded in the scripture the names of these two midwives, Shiphrah, which means beautiful one, and Puah, which means splendid one. Isn't that great? Shiphrah, beautiful one, and Puah, splendid one. But we don't have the name of the Pharaoh. We have Mr. What's-His-Name. The only names remembered are those who feared God and protected life. And God also blesses Shiphrah and Puah with families of their own, because the midwives of those days were often single women or widows. Since the midwives refused to kill the baby boys as they are born, the Pharaoh shifts tactics and decrees that the babies be thrown into the river as soon as they are born. He knew that the Nile was easily accessible for everybody, and the swift current would take away the waste, as he deemed it. But secondly, the Nile was viewed as a god. So again, he's shifting the blame. The Egyptians viewed the Nile as the giver and taker of life. Thus, they might have thought that they were doing the will of the gods. Our God, our true and living God, is not a god of death. Tossing babies into the Nile was such a perversion of any kind of worship of gods. And we can't leave the discussion of the plan to exterminate the baby boys without connecting it to the abomination of abortion in our own country. There are several unfortunate parallels that I've listed for you. It begins with disdain for those who threaten our self-interest. The Egyptians disdained the Israelites, who they thought endangered their positions of power and prestige, just as Americans disdain children as an economic liability or an unwanted burden. Secondly, the killing of the Israelites began as a matter of national policy, just as the Supreme Court decision opened the door for the mass slaughter of the innocent unborn. now that Roe v. Wade has been overturned, many states are passing extreme abortion laws, including our own state of Michigan. In our state, they have said the words, "We are enshrining abortion into the state constitution." Do you realize that enshrine means to preserve or cherish as sacred? Enshrining abortion into the Constitution. The third parallel is that the killing is subtle at first and then much more blatant. Pharaoh wanted the midwives to arrange for the death of the boy babies, making the murder appear part of the birth process. Also, Pharaoh commanded that the boy babies be thrown into the river after birth. So too nowadays, abortions which were once allowed early in pregnancy are now performed very late. And yes, even if denied, babies are terminated after birth as well, with a little sign by them as they sit on a counter, give no care, do not give care. Finally, as the murders of just the boys was selective, so we kill babies for being the wrong sex or having a possible imperfection which may make our lives inconvenient. We need to follow the example of these midwives and have no part in such atrocities. And finally, the Israelites were bound by spiritual slavery. Archaeological records show that many pharaohs wore serpents on their headdresses. I didn't really make that connection until I was studying. And the serpent, of course, reminds us of Genesis 3:15, where we learn about the enmity between the triumphant seed of the woman and the opposing seed of the serpent, the devil. And there in Exodus, the Pharaoh lived out the serpent role by killing the boys. He didn't know it, of course, but he was fulfilling Genesis 15, that there's going to be this enmity, and just get rid of the boys. If they got rid of the boys, then the girls would be swallowed up by the Egyptians, and you would no longer have a state of Israel. So the story of Exodus is really a cosmic spiritual battle. God wanted the Israelites liberated from political, economic, and social slavery that bound them. But most importantly, he wanted them to be spiritually liberated. He wanted them to be freed to worship him, the true and living God. God is going to prove his faithfulness, which we sang about just a minute ago, to the children of Israel, by delivering them from bondage, the political, economic, social, and spiritual. As we study this book, we will study the faithfulness and see it unfold, a book of deliverance and redemption. As I have looked back over my life as I enter this new decade, I have found God to be faithful. I'm sure that you will find him faithful in your life too. And we're going to listen to a video by the Brooklyn Tabernacle Choir called "He's Been Faithful." And I know it will be a blessing to you. There are many variations of that on YouTube, but I use this one, and I'll put this back up here because she's got to pull the plug to show the video. But let the words just wash over you as we hear this wonderful rendition. I'll put that back up there, but it's by the Brooklyn. You can Google and you'll see many, many, or you can put it on YouTube and you'll find many examples of this song by the Brooklyn Tabernacle Choir. But let's listen to this one.